In this episode of Movie Rollers, we talk about Suburbicon and the killing of a sacred deer. Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And yes, you as well.
Movie Rollers is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. We love the movies. This show is for you. Hello.
Hello.
And you have been on the back of an aeroplane, Joe.
I have, yeah. Gosh, I've been.
Did you watch anything exciting? Sorry, I didn't mean to break you up. No. Where were you headed? What did you do?
Well, no, I had to go to London for work. Kind of a short notice thing, but I did then take a couple of days to spend some time with my folks, which was lovely. Try and get to see them once a year, which I don't always do, and I was overdue, so that was kind of nice. But yes, folded up in the back of an airplane for many hours. I didn't watch anything new. I ended up watching the Godfather trilogy, and I hadn't seen the third one, so I decided to finish one, which I'd started watching, rewatch two, because I had seen two before, and get to number three, which was a huge disappointment. I can't get over.
Yeah.
Like, just how
shouldn't have made it.
It was not unrelated. I mean, it was bad soap opera.
Yeah. I agree.
I was so distraught by that, but no, it was still very good. And I think we covered in the last podcast, My Life as a Zucchini. Other than that, I've taken to watching copious quantities of YouTube on backs of airplanes, because if you subscribe to YouTube Red, which I do because Google has, like, that's where we get our music. You know, there's like 100 different music subscription services out there. They throw in a little subscription to YouTube Red, which allows you to download a bunch of stuff to your iPad and for viewing offline. So that's basically how I dealt with my in and out of sleep moments when I couldn't bring myself to focus on what was, something that needed a bit more attention. So that's how I got through the flight. But the Godfather trilogy was, it was. I'm glad to have finally watched the whole thing. Okay, so we have two movies to talk about today, but before we get into them, let's do our usual I Can't Find Anything to Watch on Netflix, which is our regular segment where we tell you what's in our Netflix queues, because you, like us, may have some difficulties navigating your way around the place. What do you have in your Netflix queues?
And I think this is a bit unusual, but we've all picked the same director this week, yes, which is do. Quentin Tarantino, and that was completely unplanned.
Yes.
So my pick is The Hateful Eight, which was Mr. Tarantino's last movie. Some would say not his best. I really enjoyed this. We've spoken about this when we did the review. Joe and I managed to catch a stage reading by Quentin Tarantino, and actually some of the cast that then appeared in the movie, and were just mesmerized, I think, by the stage play. And I think that made it a bit better when we watched the movie, because Quentin Tarantino movies are so rich of content. It's often difficult to digest the entire movie in one sitting and one go. So Hateful Eight is mine. I just love the tension in this movie. And it's the best Mexican standoff, you know, which he does the best. Great movie. Hateful Eight.
Some, like Yazdi, might call it his laziest movie.
Yes.
And even though it was 3 hours with an intermission.
I know, but he doesn't know what to do with all these beautiful characters he creates. I know. Anyway.
And blue coffee pots.
Oh, yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And so your pick is?
My pick is a movie where he actually got it right. He has only made 8 films, and it's incredible to believe, because he's so much a part of cinematic language.
Oh, yes.
In the last, you know, since he burst onto the scene with Pulp Fiction. But he's only made 8 movies, and so it's relatively easy to, you know, order them to your ranking. And for me, it's only second to the Kill Bill, Kill Bill 1 and 2 is Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole movie is a balancing act. There are these multiple stories going on. He has, 20 characters in the movie, and each one has one memorable scene after the other. Just the starting scene with Christoph Waltz alone is worth the price of admission.
Yes.
If somebody wants to teach somebody how to create tension right off the bat from minute one. You know, watch the opening of Inglourious Basterds. And, you know, he is so creative. He gets revisionist towards the end. He kind of has disregard for reality and he almost turns history around. It's gleefully violent. Everything which makes Tarantino so likable and so essential, I think, you know, is here in Inglourious Basterds. And I think he hasn't made a better movie since. So I'd really love this one.
And Joe, yours is. I can't believe we all picked Tarantino.
We'll have a confession.
Oh no.
With the fact that you two picked Tarantino movies, it kind of led me to put a Tarantino movie in there anyway. So not quite as spontaneous as Rashmi said. But I had to confess. But just going back to Inglourious Basterds, so there's a terrific little YouTube series called Lessons from the Screenplay. And they're like 10-minute sound bites. Inglourious Basterds is picked as one of the movies that they choose to analyze. And you know, this guy, I guess he's either a working script writer or in film school or something, but he kind of pulls apart what makes these movies work, and he does a really, really lovely analysis of Inglourious Basterds. So just a little link back to what I was saying about YouTube. There's some great stuff on there too. So yeah, Lessons from the Screenplay, do check that out, because I think it's one of my favorite episodes of that podcast. So I did also select the Tarantino movie, one that I may or may not have recommended before, but it's one of my favorite Tarantino movies, which is Jackie Brown.
Yay!
It's a very underrated movie, I think, in the legacy of Tarantino movies. It's never one that comes up in conversation. It doesn't have anything like the profile of Pulp Fiction or the Kill Bills or, you know, the... you know, Reservoir Dogs of this world. It's very much a little movie that he made, and I think it was his fourth film. He did it coming off of
Kill Bills.
Was it the Kill Bills?
I think so.
So I don't know why this movie works so well for me. What I can tell you is that I think you know, the character played by Pam Grier is delightfully understated. I think the bad guy played by Sam Jackson, the character by the name of Ordell, is seared into my brain as one of the best bad guys that Tarantino has ever written. And he's written some crackers. There's something magical about its soundtrack and the way that it uses its music, as Tarantino always does. But it's, you know, very much an homage to kind of blaxploitation movies back in the day. And, you know, it's got this, you know, very kind of soul soundtrack to it. Terrific moments, and again, you know, the classic Tarantino setup of the House of Cards, and then, you know, the push to in the final sequence where everything comes together.
Apologies, pre Kill Bill.
Oh, was it pre Kill Bill? Yeah. Okay, but it's just one of my favorite movies, and I think again, it works so well for me because, you know, you have people playing really off type here. You have De Niro in this movie with a very small part.
He's great,
but he's excellent in there, and again, he's playing very much against type. You have is it Bridget Fonda?
Yes.
In the movie,
who's unrecognizable, just
again a kind of a really whimsical but very, very very, very memorable performance. So
I have to say, Joe, you know, it's interesting that we both love Tarantino so much, and this isn't one of my favorites. For it's some not. Reason, oh, okay. No, this is actually my least favorite, if I was going to rank them.
Hmm.
For me, it doesn't go anywhere.
You know,
it's more of a meandering, something's happening, we don't quite know what, and then things are just going on.
Yeah, you're not, I think you're not unique in that opinion. Again, I don't know why this works so well for me, but it really does.
Yeah.
It's fun and it makes me smile.
Yeah.
All right, so
I think it's the least susceptible to, you know, Tarantino's flourishes. I mean, he is he's not a subtle director. He never has been. And his strength is in making things bigger and brighter and more
ridiculous.
Ridiculous and in your face. And I think this is one of his most restrained movies. And I think I think he's better for it. Because it all comes down to just very, very, very well-written plot.
Yes.
You know, it's all these pieces clicking into each other.
And the way that the protagonist ultimately prevails is so much fun to see. Because, again, it does that thing that many movies do, which is, you know, sets up traps everywhere and then off we go. All right. So, three Quentin Tarantino movies. Interesting that they're all there on Netflix at the moment. So that's, you know, again, just you may or may not be aware of that. I did not know Inglourious was playing right now.
Yeah, I didn't either. Good choice.
You know, that's something that would always be in my queue just because it's so easy to dip in and out of. And so, yeah, terrific stuff. So Jackie Brown, Inglourious Bastards, and Rashmi, yours was...
Hateful Eight.
Hateful Eight.
And just so folks know, all of these movies were produced by the Weinstein Company, and considering the trouble they are in, those movies may go away. So if there is a Tarantino you haven't watched on Netflix, please do it sooner than later. You never know. So catch up on those.
I'm sure the rights will be acquired by somebody somewhere.
Yes.
All right. So let's talk about the two movies that we are here to talk about today, which is The Killing of a Sacred Deer and Suburbicon. Which one would you like to cover first? Because I haven't seen either of these.
Killing of a Sacred Deer. No?
Sure.
No, what do you think?
Yes. Let's do it. Joe, right. Which would you like to hear about first?
Yes. You haven't seen either.
You tell us.
Let's do Killing of a Sacred Deer, primarily because this comes from director of a movie called Dogtooth and the Lobster, by directed by the name of Yorgos Lanthimos. So I've seen both of this director's, I'm not sure if they're his only two movies, but I've seen two of them.
He's just done one more.
One of them has been indelibly seared into my brain. The other one just plain pissed me off. So the first movie was Dogtooth, which we saw on Netflix. It came out to some fanfare a few years ago. It's a very small movie with a very high profile. One of the most pieces of... I'm speechless when I think about this movie and the depraved areas that it goes into. But nonetheless, I think it was a very clever narrative about, you know, it's a very small movie set almost within the confines of a single house, and the occurrences that happen within that house. But still, a very fascinating look at the way that the world could be if somebody had excluded the rest of the world from the occurrences of that house. His next movie, The Lobster, was a very metaphorical movie, I think. It was to do with, it had Colin Farrell in it, and frankly, it was a movie that annoyed me in every which way possible, because as metaphorical as it was, these felt like random metaphors. You know, it's like, let's drive down the car in a mushroom. You know, that's not something that would happen in real life, and that doesn't happen in the movie, but it's the kind of thinking that is at play in this movie.
Poor Joe.
So I didn't get it. So I'm kind of intrigued by this movie, but
you're kind
I've got
of
to
relieved
be honest,
that we didn't drag you to this right?
I think you should see it.
I'm not sure that I'll love it. So, with that said, I'll give you the synopsis here, which is Dr. Stephen Murphy, again played by Colin Farrell, who clearly is a good muse for Dr. Lanthimos, is a renowned cardiovascular surgeon presiding over a spotless household with his ophthalmologist wife, played by Nicole Kidman, and their exemplary children, Bob and 14-year-old Kim. Lurking at the margins of his idyllic suburban existence is Martin, a fatherless teen who Stephen has covertly taken under his wing. This is all sounding very Dogtooth to me. As Martin begins insinuating himself into the family's ever more unsettling displays, the full scope of his intent becomes menacingly clear when he confronts Stephen with a long-forgotten transgression that will shatter the Murphy family's domestic bliss. So R-rated, as is any work by this director. Nicole Kidman, Colin Farrell, Barry Keoghan, Alicia Silverstone. Gosh, really? She's here?
Mm-hmm.
Haven't seen her forever. Rafi Cassidy, Bill Camp. What did you think of The Killing of a Sacred Deer?
Oh, Joe. I'm sad that you don't love Dogtooth and Lobster as much as Yazdi and I do, because I think both of us, I speak for both of us when we say we love Yorgos Lanthimos movies. They're not always easy to watch, but they're thought-provoking and they ask you to think about existential questions in a really deep and meaningful way. And they always have a little bit of sci-fi thrown in them for good measure, but they're kind of set in a real world. And it's kind of sci-fi, not in an alien way, but in a, the world is not quite right and what we're used to way. Here we have another one. But I would say that I think this is probably more accessible than the two movies that you mentioned. And if I had to describe the movie without giving away a spoiler, I would describe it. And I often ask my niece this question, who loves me more than she loves Joe. If you had to save one of us in a burning house, which one would you save? And of course, she always says me. So I kind of think this is that metaphor in some ways. And again, I say that without giving any of the plot away. I love this movie.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm watching a Yorgos Lanthimos movie, I am very disturbed. And I think that's the desired intent.
What he wants absolutely you to
disturb. He has reckless disregard for the audience's approval or audience's
peace of mind
comfort. Or any of that, or comfort. And he's like, I'm going to make a movie that is going to really test you. And yet, you know, with having, I've seen 3 out of the 4 movies he's made. The only other one he's made is a movie called The Alps, which I should get my hands on one of these days. Yet he's with just these 3 movies almost created a genre within cinema.
Yes.
Where he's become
good observation.
You know, a master of the disquiet. I mean, he really creates this sense of something really, really wrong so quickly. And he really makes you squirm in your chair. And this is not a, you know, I think this is the most accessible movie. It has the most linear storyline. It's probably the most easy to understand. It doesn't require any leaps of imagination. It has only one piece, I think, which kind of, you know, is outside the realms of reality and it forms the crux of the movie. But having said so, it's not an easy, I think it might be his most disquieting movie, but you know, you walk away from the movie and I have 100 things I want to say about this movie. And you know, that he's able to create in each of his movies a world with their own rules. And he did that most remarkably in The Lobster. You know, it's created this very, you know, hermetically sealed world with its own weird rules. And it sticks with those rules. Here again, in The Killing of a Sacred Deer, he creates one rule and the movie sticks by it. And by virtue of that, it makes you ask all these great big questions. And, you know, when he has these actors at his disposal, who are going to go with him and jump off the cliff with him every time he leaps, and he leaps off the cliff many times in this movie, you have something, it's quite a cinema experience. I think we're so inured and we see the same thing over and over again, and something which is marginally better is celebrated like, oh, this is the best Marvel movie. No, it's not. It's marginally better than the other ones. But anyway, you know, it's so great to have a filmmaker who just literally shakes you by the shoulders. And he will shake you by the shoulder. You walk out of there like shaken. And I love that somebody has the capacity to do that. So I'm rambling a lot. I think this movie is brilliant. I don't recommend it to everyone. But if you're a lover of cinema and you don't mind getting a little bit spooked out, God, go watch this movie. I want this movie to... It's not even catching on. I want people to go watch it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that I can't stop thinking about this movie. Like, I've loved a lot of movies in these last few months, or started to like movies again in the last few months.
I was going
to
say.
Yeah, but there was a, you know, most of them go away. And I think as we're kind of wrapping up the year and we're starting to think about our own nominations that we're going to put forward to the San Diego Film Critics Society, I'm starting to sort of consolidate in my mind what are the performances and films I want to put forward. And most of them have evaporated from my head. Mm-hmm. I can't stop thinking about this movie. This is such a smart, strange, foreboding, tense movie that just keeps you on the edge of your seat, because at first you just don't know what's happening. And it's actually something different that you think is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you know what's happening, it's equally tense
and
because
terrifying.
You don't know how it's going to end.
Yeah.
And of course, there are a few holes. But overall, it's just a really enjoyable movie. But the thing that stunned me the most is the acting and the twists and turns. Now, I'm not a big fan of Nicole Kidman because I always find her cold and distant. That cold and distant, yeah, performance is pitch perfect in this movie. In fact, I would even consider nominating her for Best Supporting Actress in this movie. And then Colin Farrell is just such a different Colin Farrell. It was Vanity Free and Lobster. This is a whole level of Vanity Free performance, and it does him so well. I mean, I just...
Yeah.
Again, I'm considering Best Actor. Because it's hard to play this type of character.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about this for an hour, by the way. To Joe's chagrin, but...
yeah, you've got this huge smile on your face, and I think Joe's thinking, I'm going to hate this movie, right?
See, nothing that you've said so far has got me
really
running to the movie theater. And I say that because I think a lot of what you have said is equally applicable to Dogtooth and The Lobster, and I think both of those rubbed me up the wrong way. Dogtooth, I succumbed to it ultimately, and I think its darkness was repulsive but intoxicating. The Lobster was just
annoying, just
nauseating. Yeah.
No. This one is repulsive but intoxicating for sure. And you know, okay. There's many things I want to talk about, but the acting. You know, he deliberately in all his movies has all of his actors speak in this, you know, very dispassionate, you know, lack of intonation. They all speak very flat, like they're doing a line reading, and he kind of almost drains all inflections from their voices.
Yeah, and he does great that. Observation.
You know, it's there in Dogtooth. It's there in The Lobster. It's very much there with Colin Farrell's character. And I wish I was there on the set when this movie was being filmed, because I'm sure he asked Nicole Kidman to do the same thing, and she tries her best, but somehow her instincts as an actor somehow shine through, and she's not able to do as deadpan or as committedly as Colin Farrell does. And it actually creates a very nice contrast between the two characters. And, you know, absolutely, Nicole Kidman, for the length of her career, has been accused of being a very cold presence, a very clinical, detached, the opposite of a warm presence. But let nobody accuse her of not being a brave actor. She is brave.
In droves.
She just goes with this movie. She's like, you want this from me? I'm going to give it to you.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't think of any contemporary A-list actor, you know, who would eat both of them, you know, Colin Farrell as well as Nicole Kidman, who would have kind of, you know, gone hand in hand with this director. And so absolutely, and Barry Keoghan, who has the biggest,
thank you.
You know, he's the plot pivot point for the plot. He was in Dunkirk, and you just told me he was in
71.
In 71, the great movie from last year.
Yeah,
he has the most difficult role here.
I'm gonna say standout phenomenon.
Yeah, but his role, I cannot even explain how difficult his role is, and he just nails it. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say anything, because anything I say is a spoiler. But whatever his character is meant to symbolize, he's able to do it without making the audience laugh with incredulity.
Yeah.
Because some other actor would have just made this whole character just crumble.
Or the way it's written, overacted it. He is able to capture this youth and naivety at the forefront and at the center of the movie. Yet there's this underlying single white female essence that hides.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's amazing. I don't know if that's great direction, great acting. Standout performance, Barry Keoghan. This is just incredible. And welcome back, Alicia Silverstone. There's not enough of her.
Yeah,
there's but not what enough we of her. Get is just delightful. I mean, it's crazy. Delightful.
It's the anti-Alicia Silverstone.
It was so good.
It's not Clueless, Alicia.
It's anti-Clueless. It's anti-Cher.
It's anti-Cher. Yeah, and I mean, I think to the movie's great, you know, to its great credit, just like in The Lobster, it creates its own weird ethical rules, and then it brings you to this point. And if you believe those rules, then just the moral and ethical dilemma those characters are faced with puts you in a amazingly real situation of what would I do? And that's where the movie becomes really terrifying, because even though you believe in reality, this might not happen, but if it has happened to you, what would you do? And I was absolutely terrified in terms of what I would do in that situation. And I think that's where the unease of the movie comes from. And he's so good with how the scenes are composed. I mean, you know, the music is so discordant. I mean, there's this cello thing, you know, this discordant, like stretching cello, which is playing, and it.
Yeah, I put down violins about to stress their strings at times.
Yeah, and it's such a unique piece of cinema. And I think for me, it raises all these questions, such as science versus belief. It raises questions about evil in the world. We often, in cinemas, evil is represented as, you know, a villain who is nefarious. But what's most chilling is actually when evil is very banal, when it's just sitting in front of you and you don't see it.
Well, an eye for an eye.
And oh, yeah, where any ordinary person, if they want to take it upon themselves to be fully committed to their action, they could be the representation of evil in a heartbeat. And it so beautifully renders that point. So there's so much to talk about it in terms of morality, in terms of marriage, in terms of guilt, in terms of, I mean, we talked about Mother for a whole podcast. Here's another movie which begins with a shot of a person who is like God. He's doing a heart surgery and he's saving a person. And Colin Farrell's character is very much godlike and therefore very vain and therefore very, he thinks too much of himself. And will he have a price to pay for it? And it's funny to compare it with Mother, but it's kind of along those same ethical lines. And the very fact that I'm so excited a month after seeing this.
Yeah, I want to go see. I'll go see it again with you, Joe. Go see this again. Yeah, I mean, I can wrap up.
Yes.
I mean, look, this world is so cleverly devoid of love and warmth. Yet the idea of this movie depends on your ability to put yourself in the main protagonist's shoes and ask you to figure out what you would do if those things that you love are taken away. That combined with a clever score, like I said, Yazdi, of these foreboding violins about to stress their strings at times, is just a terrific journey that will stay with you long after the curtain comes up, because it's that thought-provoking. 9 out of 10.
Wow. Yazdi?
I'm tempted to give it a 9 out of 10, but I'll give it 8.5 out of 10. And then it's definitely going to be on my top 10 list. Definitely going to be on my top 10 list. When I came out, I was so shaken by the movie that, you know, when they asked for my reaction, I said, I love this movie, but I don't think I want to see it again, because it had such a strong effect on me. And it's kind of part Sophie's Choice, part Dogtooth. And, you know, he creates, like in Dogtooth, he creates this oppressive atmosphere that is just unbearable. And, you know, very few, Shyamalan used to have it to some degree early on in his career, but, you know, Yorgos Lanthimos is just so weird and he just commits so much to it that, There's nobody quite like the movie
with Dogtooth. I mean, it was something we watched on Netflix.
Of, you know, youthfulness and, you know, coming of age and deflowering and that's, you know, he goes there.
He really goes there. And I think my one complaint about Lanthimos is that, you know, when he wants to leap into the bizarre, I mean, he invariably goes for the easiest option, which is like sexual depravity, which I wish there's other ways to be bizarre, but he again and again kind of, that seems like the easy way out for him to kind of get to crazy town.
I know exactly what Yazdi's talking about. Joe, you will get a kick out of that one scene.
So I wish he didn't do that much of it. It just seems like an obvious thing. Like, okay, fine. Let me create bizarre. So, okay, let's do something sexually depraved.
But you know what, Yazdi? I think what he's trying to convey here is that often suburbia, and we're going to talk about suburbicon in this show as well, which is interesting. Suburbia is an interesting place, and when you pull the curtain back from suburbia, you don't know what's going on in people's houses. And it is our desire for things that cause us to get into problems. So I think he's actually very smart in the way that he conveys that depravity. I don't like depravity in movies for the sake of it. And remember, I'm the prude of the three of us that kind of gets offended when it's just for the sake of it. Here I can totally buy it, and it's that's a lot of naked body. And I can totally buy this because I understand the context in which he's trying to operate.
Yeah. And okay. Just visually, the movie
Joe is not tempted. I can see from Joe's face, he's like, I'm going to go, I'm going to hate this movie.
Here's where I am. I don't think I'm going to like it, but I feel now like I have to see it.
Yes.
And I think you've done your job in that regard, in that I think you've built this up as something that's important to watch. So I think...
If you love cinema, it's challenging.
Which, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm, I think if you, I'm there.
Yeah. And I think like Mother, this is a movie which somebody will walk out of it thinking, oh my God, this is like, you know, the, so brilliant. Or they'll come out of it just hating it. They were like, I wanted to leave in the first 5 minutes and this is the, you know, 2 hours of my life wasted and this person needs to check into a... You know,
I will happily walk out. If this goes to lobster territory in the first 15 minutes, I'm done.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And I think, Yazdi, you're right. You know, I wouldn't recommend this to everyone. Yeah. Only if you're a film lover and you're looking for a challenge and you want to see something different. Okay, we will move on.
I was going to say, we've managed to get half an hour into the podcast and we still have a movie to do. Okay. So let's move on quickly to Suburbicon. And Suburbicon is the latest from George Clooney. He's building his resume here as a director. He's had a couple of movies in recent years, The Ides of March, which was extremely well received, and The Monument Men, which was less well received. Yeah. So Suburbicon is... another entry onto his CV as a director. We all obviously know George Clooney very well for his public persona as well as his acting
and his human rights
and
campaigns.
Well, that's what I'm saying, his public everything. He's seemingly you know, one of the good guys of Hollywood, and he has that ridiculously charming smile. So I am a little distracted here by Yazdi. That has to be Instagram to Movie Wallace. So go ahead and do that right now. So Yazdi's just taken a picture of our cat that has crawled into her Studio Ghibli cat bed, which it consists of a cat head with a big gaping mouth.
It's a cat and a cat. And
it so is a cat and a cat.
There's something Yorgos Lanthimos about.
There is actually, yes.
A cat sleeping in the cat's mouth. But nonetheless, it's very cute. So please do post that to our Instagram. So let's just quickly introduce Suburbicon. Written by Joel and Ethan Coen, which is always good to see. I think, again, they don't always direct the stuff that they write. They've written a lot more than... they've actually directed. Suburbicon is a peaceful, idyllic suburban community with affordable homes and manicured lawns. The perfect place to raise a family. And in the summer of 1959, the Lodge family is doing just that. But the tranquil surface masks a disturbing reality as husband and father Garner Lodge must navigate the town's dark underbelly of betrayal, deceit, and violence. This is a tale of very flawed people making very bad choices. This is Suburbicon. As I mentioned, George Clooney directs, but he has a wonderful cast at his disposal. He has Matt Damon, Julianne Moore, Oscar Isaac, Glenn Fleshler, Noah Jupe, among others. So another one that I missed, which, you know, this movie, I'm mixing it up with the other one, the reductionist one, you know, the movie where the people are going to get
downsizing.
Also with Matt Damon.
Yeah, so in my brain, I think this was the movie that I was thinking of when I thought of Suburbicon, but this is something different. But nonetheless, it was one that I know has been getting a lot of hype coming into this fourth quarter. So what did you think of Suburbicon?
So in terms of backstory, this was a script which was written by Joel and Ethan Coen and the Coen brothers. And apparently it's been sitting around for a while. Or they were trying to make a movie and they never got around to moving it. And Clooney, famously, because he's worked with them a lot, you know, asked if he could direct this movie. And that's the part of the story which has, you know, Matt Damon and Julianne Moore in playing twin sisters. And, you know, it has Noah Jupe and, you know, all these other actors. And then, if I understand this correctly, Clooney wrote a second story which goes side by side. And the only similarity between these two stories is it's stories which play out in two neighboring homes in this small suburban town in the mid-50s. And that particular story that Clooney has added is a very serious story about racism and about how this, you know, black family moves into a predominantly white, you know, picket fence neighborhood. The first part of the story, the part which deals with Matt Damon, is like, you know, a lot of the Coen brothers movies. It's mean and it's nasty and it's fun and it's, you know, it's kind of like Blood Simple. Have you seen Blood Simple from the Coen brothers? Oh, it's... you know, it's this double over triple over quadruple crossings, you know, and so forth. And I think my single biggest complaint about the movie is that those two stories tonally don't sit well next to each other. And he juxtaposes those two repeatedly again and again. And it always seems anachronistic because one is this very deep, dark, dark humor. And the other one is very, very, very serious social outrage. And you, the two just don't fit well together. But having said that, I think a lot of, I was one of those people who walked out of the cinema and criticized that. Who does Clooney think he is? You know, he is no Coen Brothers. He's no Coen Brothers. But I think with what he's doing, you know, I didn't like the movie as much when I first saw it. But this is another movie which is remarkably stuck in my head, and I'm still thinking about it. And it's grown in my admiration, because if something horrible were to happen to the Coen Brothers, I wouldn't mind Clooney making movies based on Coen Brothers scripts. And so both of those parts work very well together. I enjoyed it thoroughly. This is a movie which is growing in esteem as I think more about it.
So yes, you are aligned again. Look, I think just because you're good at picking apples, it doesn't mean that you're good at cooking pears. So I think that Clooney is a fine actor. And I think although he's had some good directing efforts, he's no great director yet.
Yeah.
I think that will come. For me, this was one of the most anticipated movies of this quarter because it's written by the Coen brothers, and I love the Coen brothers. And I was thinking, oh, it's directed by Clooney. But exactly like Yazdi said, you know, look, the opening 5 minutes are phenomenal. Unfortunately, however, overall, this was a little bit of a fail for me, a bit of a major disappointment. And I understand what Clooney's trying to do with these parallel stories. You know, you have this typical 50s, 60s America, and then there's an African-American family. But the African-American part didn't add anything to the already existing spicy story that I think if we'd just been focused on that and left that one alone, this would have actually been a much, much better movie. But the other piece that he has written on top of a Coen brothers very good script is a bolt-on, and it feels like a bolt-on, therefore. So it lowers my esteem of the film overall. But this is, you know, this is ludicrously violent. And I think where it fails then is it lacks the smartness and bite that a Coen brothers normally has throughout the movie. So you get this bite sometimes, but then you're taken out of that bite and put in a social situation that clearly he's trying to mirror what's happening in the US today. And the divisiveness of racial tension and what's happened, you know, the sad events of Charlottesville, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't quite work. And unfortunately for me, Yazdi, it hasn't risen in esteem since I left. I do like, I like Fat Damon, is what I call him.
Or Wide Damon. He's become really wide.
Yeah. I like the Fat Damon character. Yeah, because I think when he comes as Fat Damon, he's always fun to watch. And he brings something else than when you see him in like a Bourne Identity movie. And I like that bumbling, clumsy dad character who's really not good at much, but kind of does what it takes to get what he wants. So I think there are some excellent themes in here in the Coen brothers story. I admire what he was trying to do with the African-American story, but unfortunately it's like oil and water.
That's too bad, because I think it has some intriguing elements to it from, you know, from as somebody who hasn't seen it.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if he just left the script alone, I would be saying this would be a 9 out of 10 for me, I think, because it's that funny and crazy and Coen brothers.
Yeah, I mean, I also wonder if we didn't know that this was directed by George Clooney, if we might be more favorable towards this film. I mean, I think because he's such a successful actor, you know, we expect him to kind of really knock it out of the park. And I don't know if some no-name actor would have made it. I mean, no-name filmmaker director, would have made it out of a Coen Brothers script, then maybe if he would have liked it more. And I'm particularly saying this because this movie's got a real beating, you know, critically. It has, it's only like 25% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah,
I would put it much higher than that because, you know, when I walked out of the film, I thought that, you know, even though these two pieces are anachronistic, okay, fine, I'm going to set that aside. And I originally felt the whole part about the black family seemed a little overcooked, and it seemed like, come on, you know, even in the worst of times, this wouldn't have happened. But then, since I watched the movie, you read the news and you realize, eh, yeah, this is going on right now. So maybe I'm too much on Clooney's side, you know, socially or politically, that I kind of feel compelled to defend him. But it doesn't seem as overcooked now to me, you know, that whole part.
Mm-hmm.
And go on.
No, I just want to say though, Yazdi, I think it's good at saying, isn't it sad that we're still experiencing this in 2017?
Right.
Unfortunately, the mirror it's holding up to us isn't large enough. And yeah. I think that it's not ugly enough to take you anywhere. So we don't get to a destination. That's the problem. We have no arc. We have no destination to go to in that part of the story. And so it's just, oh, look what's going on over here.
Yeah. And, you know, Manuela Dargis in New York Times is withering in a review of the movie. And she actually accuses Clooney that with all his good intentions and holier than thou, you know, sanctimoniousness about how badly the whites have treated the blacks, you know, he has created a movie where there are two parallel stories and supposedly all the A&M actors are in the white portion of the story. And all, you know, the black portion,
that's a great point.
The black portion of the story, you know, look what he's doing with all his best intentions. Isn't he himself?
That's a great observation.
Being guilty of treating that whole story like a second-class story. And I don't know how maybe it is, but I still don't doubt Clooney's intentions. But set that whole social commentary piece aside, I really enjoyed the part with Matt Damon and Julianne Moore and, you know, the little girl from the Florida Project, Brooklyn Prince, is getting a lot of buzz about being such a great child actor. I thought the little boy who plays... Yes. Matt Damon's son, Noah Jupe, is so good here.
Yes,
I thought he was so much better than, you know, the Brooklyn Prince character, because he is kind of seeing, he's the audience member. He is seeing the reality of the world around him with all its dark shades. And he's realizing that there is no sure thing. There is no source of good in the world, that everything is rotten, possibly. And it's hard to convey that as a child without coming off precocious or what have you. So, you know, that little piece really worked for me. It's brutally violent. It's dark humor.
It's Coen Brothers.
It's Coen Brothers. And it did work for me. Yeah. The Coens have done a better job with it. Of course they would have.
Yeah. I mean, Julianne Moore is delightful to watch.
Julianne Moore is so good.
She's really good in this. I mean, it's a much more restrained performance than The Kingsman, but it's in Kingsman territory.
That shit crazy.
Kind of, yeah. But it's good. It's good crazy. And Oscar Isaac, where have you been?
Yes.
I love him in this movie.
Like Star Wars, I think, is where he's been spending his time.
Yeah, everyone's been there.
Go on. I mean, every review you read, everybody says how the first part of the movie is a snooze until he comes along. I really disagree with that. I really enjoy the first part of the movie, but there is no question about it. The minute he walks into the movie, it's like a jolt of electricity.
He's delightful.
It's like a jolt of electricity. And I think, you know, the movie is worse once he's no longer in it. You know, he's there in the middle of it and it's just... It's electricity the whole time he's there.
Yeah.
He's so good at it.
So good.
Best supporting actor.
Yeah, good. I agree.
He just lifts the movie up to a whole other level.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, go on. Wrap this one up, Yazdi.
So, you know, I would have ordinarily given this a 6 or I would have given it a 7. But by virtue of the fact that people are pooping on this movie so much, and I think it's beautifully created, maybe Clooney got carried away with his, you know... social agenda a little bit. So I kind of feel like I should be the one defending it a little bit. So I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10 because I would not recommend this movie. It's very entertaining. You know, it's unexpected. I, for one, didn't see most of the twists and turns coming. I was moved by it reasonably well. These are great actors at the top of their game. Julianne Moore, you know, Matt Damon, etc. So... good stuff. 8 out of 10.
Oh, look, what's that? It's a poop.
oh, come on.
Look, this is shy of great. If this had been just the Matt Damon story, I'd be giving this an 8 or a 9 out of 10. Unfortunately, it's not. It's diluted by the other story that just didn't work for me. I don't think this is a rush out and see, although I think it has some great acting in it. And I agree with Yazdi. Oscar Isaac, best supporting actor. Yeah. At least a nomination, if not a final, you know, he goes in the top five. For me, you know, because of that, I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10.
Wow.
It's, yeah, because honestly, I loved the Matt Damon story.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So 45 minutes into the podcast, let's call it a day. We have one more to record, and then we're going to get some food.
Yes.
So you didn't need to know that, listeners, but I wanted to share that in some way.
We eat.
Yeah.
So
it's one of those rare outings again.
You can contact us in many ways. Yazdi is going to post that picture he took of Callie to Instagram. Yes. reminder, nag, nag, moan, moan. So you can check it out there, and do check out, you know, also our website. I should give our website a plug from time to time, because you guys are very good at putting written content up there.
We do, yeah.
So, you know, in addition to the podcast, if you listen to this, there's some, the occasional written word from the movie Wallahs, not by me, by the others, but some smaller films that we don't get to record, but we may have seen. Rashmi did a nice write-up of The Viceroy's House recently, so do check out the website as well. Until our next episode, Too Many Movies, Too Little Time, a goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.